been working off and on or sporadically with from usually 3-year-olds and up. And if there's a precocious 2-year-old, that's fine too, and they can do well. At least you get the idea of the part of the world about which we're going to be talking for a while. We're talking about the Bible lands. We're talking about those three maps in particular that we had up last Wednesday night. And you see that with the children, we did something that is also beneficial for us as well. When we used not only the real names of the various places, but also used funny names. And instantaneously, the children can make the correlation between the funny names and the places. And as we say the funny names and the real names, and they become familiar with the places, they can eventually begin using the real names of the places. And these are things that they will remember for a long, long time. I've used these things with regard to young ones when we have maybe something called pew packers or something of that nature, Sunday evenings before services begin, or some congregations have had us give the first 10 or 15 minutes of a service time for that. Gospel meetings or other opportunities to preach or speak around the country, I've included that sort of thing. For years, I was teaching at Polishing the Pulpit, young ones, on this subject every year, all ages. And so it's something which I have an interest in. It's something we can learn very easily, relatively speaking. And Bible geography is something that is included in virtually all, if not all, of the preacher training school's curriculum. And some give more attention to it and some a little bit less, but the idea is that Bible geography, or knowing something about the Bible lands, knowing something about the people of the Bible lands, knowing something about the time periods involved, knowing something about the different cultures that are involved, can not only be very interesting, but also rewarding when it comes to examining the biblical text. When I was teaching at the West Virginia School of Preaching, on one occasion, or more than one occasion, would tell my students that you come across some word you don't know what is, some hard to pronounce name in some personal study, some classroom activity, that they could just say buttermilk and move on. I mean, they might as well say buttermilk if you don't know what it means, and go on. And to my surprise, one time during chapel, one of my students was preaching to everybody present, you know, students, faculty, and visitors. He got to something in the course of his lesson, said buttermilk. I didn't mean for it to go out of the classroom into the pulpit, but we want to be able to do better than buttermilk when it comes to some of the places and some of the geography, some of the culture, and some of the things that are backdrops to the biblical text, so that we can more easily, more effectively study God's Word. On the screen behind me, we have about 3 or 4 slides left from what I began to show last Wednesday night. We showed a number of different slides. One of the most impressive, from my point of view, was the satellite view of the of Palestine, showing the Jordan River Valley that runs from the bottom of the, or south of the Sea of Galilee, down to the mouth of the Dead Sea. On either side of that valley, we have mountains. We have mountains ranging up to about 3,000 feet high on the western side of the Jordan River Valley. We have mountains rising up to 4,000 feet high on the east side of the Jordan River Valley. The Jordan River Valley is from 2 miles wide to about 12 miles wide. And then the Jordan River itself drops an average of 22 feet per mile in its journey. And so it feeds the Dead Sea, the lowest by elevation body of water on the face of the planet. There are no rivers leaving the Dead Sea. The only way that water can escape from the Dead Sea is by evaporation. And so we find that there's a great earthquake fault underneath the Jordan River Valley that goes beyond that part of the world down into Africa, and very active with earthquakes from time to time. But the water is going down, the valley is going down, 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 down for all those miles from the south of the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. So if we're dropping down to about 1,300 feet below sea level, and we have on either side of the Jordan River Valley mountains going up 4,000 feet on one side and 3,000 feet on the other, we have a very deep ditch for the length of the Jordan River Valley. Very very, something we wouldn't see here, something we wouldn't imagine would be the case, but something also that will have an effect on our understanding of some parts of the biblical text. So that's one most impressive picture for me. We show pictures of Old Testament layouts of populations of various peoples and countries, and then put modern overlays of countries on top of them. The last thing we talked about was this slide right here. It looks at a passage of scripture. Here it is, 1 Kings chapter 12, 29 to 26. It says, "And Jeroboam, that is the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, said in his heart, 'Now the kingdom may return to the house of David, yet these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah.' Therefore the king asked advice, made two calves of gold, and said to the people, It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt.' And he set up one in Bethel and one in," he put in, "Dan." There's several things we want to notice from this particular text. And because we're talking about Bible geography, it also has to do with topography or the elevation of the land. The prepositions that are used here have to do with elevation, don't have to do with, as we would think in this country, going south or going north. We think about going up. We think about going to the northland of the country. If we're in the northland, talk about going down. We think about going south. That's not the way these prepositions are being used here. But they refer to the elevation of the land. They refer to the topography. They refer to the geography there. And so we know that the divided kingdom of Israel was north of Judah. So Jerusalem is south of Judah. And so when it says go up to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, they're not talking about going north, talking about going in elevation upward, getting to the mountain city of Jerusalem. That appears twice in that context. And then we have references to the cities of Dan and Bethel. The bottommost or southernmost city in the northern kingdom of Israel, the divided kingdom, was Bethel, about 12 miles north of Jerusalem. And the northernmost city in the northern kingdom of Israel was the city of Dan. And so those two sites were selected as, from a logistical perspective, from a strategy of putting these golden calves, this idol worship, in convenient places so that nobody throughout the northern kingdom of Israel would be very distant from, not too far from attending these idols. And certainly would have to pass the idol at Bethel in order to get to Jerusalem. And so if they were satisfied with the idol worship, then they would just stop at Bethel. And so the entire northern kingdom immediately went into idolatry with Jeroboam coming out of exile in Egypt, being made their king, and then establishing this idol worship there as an alternative to going back and worshiping the true God in the city of Jerusalem. Anybody, any questions or comments at this point regarding what we just talked about? Anybody, anything? Feel free to speak up. And like I said last week, if you can't seem to get a word in edgewise, why, raise your hand, speak up, stand up, or whatever. My late wife Bonnie told me that my teaching is a whole lot like preaching, can't get a word in edgewise. But we want you to get a word in edgewise once in a while if you have a desire to do that. On this slide, we have a number of passages that use this same phraseology of going up to Jerusalem. When we're not talking about going up north or down south, we're talking about geography, talking about the elevation of the land. And then we have it more clearly seen in Luke 19 and verse 28. "And when he had thus spoken, he went before it, ascending up to Jerusalem." So that's simply something that we might miss, might not be aware of as we would read text ordinarily. We have this in a similar vein in Luke chapter 10 and verse 30. "Then Jesus answered and said, A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead." And so when you think about the geography in connection with this passage of Scripture, we would begin to have a picture, an image in our minds of what's going on. Now, the city of Jericho is, if I recall correctly, I believe it's true, 800 feet below sea level. The city of Jerusalem is 2,550 feet above sea level. And so and Jericho is 16 miles away from Jerusalem. And so in 16 miles, we're dropping down, if my math is right, about 3,300 feet. Now, can you imagine experiencing that? I'm sure we have parts of our country where, not Florida, mind you, but we have parts of our country where in 16 miles you could be going up or down 3,300 feet. And so we have very rugged terrain going toward Jericho, going toward the Jordan River Valley from Jerusalem. And there are a lot of places that the robbers could hide and ambush people, and it was a difficult trek in the first place. And so here are these individuals coming and going up that road. And so we have the backdrop for Luke chapter 10 and verse 30 regarding geography, regarding topography or the elevation of the land, gives us a little bit more information than simply reading the text as to what the backdrop of that would be. And then in Luke 11 and verse 44, and this isn't necessarily geography, or this is not topography necessarily. This, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like graves which are not seen, and the men who walk over them are not aware of them. And this simply refers to that there are or were a lot of unmarked graves in that part of the world. I'm sure we have our share of unmarked graves in North America too. Think about the history of this nation. Before the Europeans came here, this continent was populated. People were living and dying. People were having wars with each other between tribes and so forth of the Native Americans. We have various European powers come here, and we have wars between them acted out upon North America. In Michigan, I guess about 5 European flags at different times flew over and claimed Michigan as part of a European nation. Wars and wars and wars. And there are several forts up there. The oldest continually inhabited city in North America is where? Or in the U.S. is where? Okay, St. Augustine. Do you know where the second continually occupied city is in North America or in the USA? Where is it? Anybody know? It is in Michigan on the Straits of Mackinac. And it's St. Ignace. And there's a fort there. And then on the southern side of the Michigan Peninsula, there is another fort called Michimilimack. It's been restored, a nice place to visit. An island in the Straits of Mackinac, Mackinac Island, has 2 forts on it. It has a stone fort on the waterfront of the harbor. It has an earthen fort on the hill overlooking the stone fort. And so as nations were fighting each other, nobody defended the backside of the island because it was impregnable. Nobody could scale the cliff, and nobody would come in that way to attack. But somebody did. They hauled up cannons up the cliff. They built an earthen fort during the evening, laid the cannons down, barrels down on the earth, and aimed it down at the fort, fired one shot, and the stone fort gave up. So there are a lot of unmarked graves around the world, I'm sure, and that was the case, and that's the reference in this particular scripture here. So there are things we can know about the world of the Bible that can give us some further insight and give us some backdrop, some extra information with regard to the passages under consideration. You can't read this from where you are. Don't expect you to. But we'll use it as an example. This is a timeline of about 4,000 years of human history and interaction with God. And so we have a creation by some estimates. The various chronologies of humanity vary depending upon who was doing it. Here we have 4,000 B.C. We have creation represented on that chart. We have the universal flood about 2,000 years later with the Tower of Babel, a little bit after that. We have the call of Abraham in 1921 B.C. We have Jacob and his family settled in Egypt. We have Egypt enslaves the Israelites. We have Moses leads the Israel out of Egypt. Then on the little box to the right, we have a reference to 430 years, which Scripture says regarding the captivity of the Israelites in those various passages that are cited. So those bolded lines there correspond to that particular box. And then we have 1451, Joshua conquering, beginning to conquer Canaan. We have the beginning of the Judges following that. We have the United Kingdom beginning with Saul, and then passes on 40 years later to David, passes on 40 years later to Solomon. We have the attacks by Assyria of Israel. And then we have eventually the Babylonians conquer the Assyrians, and then they do in fact conquer Jerusalem. We have 70 years of captivity indicated by that box on the right there. Some passages there cited. And then the years and the events that correspond to that. And then we have the returns from captivity in the next several lines. We have the beginning of the translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek called the Septuagint or Septuagint. And then we have what comes all the way up to Rome taking possession of Canaan or Palestine from the Israelites. And then we have the birth of Christ because of an error made in the calendar too long ago to fix. And we have Jesus being born approximately 4 BC. We have then the Jesus being crucified at the beginning of the church, approximately AD 30 or AD 33, depending upon whether we compensate for the error in the calendar. And then we have Paul. We have Roman general Titus destroys Jerusalem in AD 70. We have the Apostle John writing the book of Revelation. Again, not everybody agrees regarding the date of the book of Revelation either, but generally it's AD 95. We have the end of the apostolic period around the end of the first century. And so those are some estimates to give some context to Bible study. So we're going to now, after we entertain any questions or comments that you might have, begin taking a look at the Bible lands a little bit more closely, bit by bit, piece by piece. Anybody, anything you want to add, subtract, or modify at this juncture? Anybody, anything? Well, if you think of anything, well, don't hesitate to bring that to our attention. If you you don't have to have a book, I'm going to be using a book, so to speak. I've got it electronically on my tablet there. I have plans A, B, C, and D every place I go in this country or abroad to speak. A is when everything works out just perfectly like you plan. B and C, not so much. D is when everything has failed, you just stand there and talk. And I get to D sometimes very quickly. I was using a church's equipment in Tennessee. I can't even remember what state it was now. It was Alabama. And we get into about the third slide of a mission presentation, and their machine quits. And never did recover. And so we went immediately from plan A to plan D. It all works out. And so we don't have figured out yet regarding how we can take advantage of some of the equipment here that might have more visual things for us to observe there. But the books are available if you want them. You don't have to have them. But we'll give you some information and see if we can benefit from that. Now, I don't expect us to memorize this stuff. I am a well-noted preacher. That means I use a lot of notes. That's all it means. I use a lot of notes. If I didn't have any notes, I'd be as dumb as a brick. So I use notes. And so I have my lesson on my tablet. I've got a computer over there with it on it. I have it printed out right here, highlighted, so I can, you know what I want to say. And so we're going to, as long as my mind doesn't fail, we'll just go on and see what we can do with it. So we want to look at a Bible lands overview, first of all. So we're done with that. I'll turn that off. $5. Unless you don't have any money, then they don't cost you anything. No, they're on this pew right here. If you want one, raise your hand and I'll get you one. Or you can come up and get it. Martha's my cashier. And one or more members have volunteered to provide or have provided more money than the book that they got, so that anybody who doesn't have the funds readily available, you know, you just take it back with you and you're good. And so we begin with the Bible lands, and we look at, we think about the northern extremity of the Bible lands, we think about the southern extremity of the Bible lands, we think about the most eastern, to your left, Martha. You think about the most eastern extremity of the Bible lands, you think about the most western part of the extremity of the Bible lands, and we come up with these points for points of reference. Mount Ararat is the northernmost point of the Bible lands. Mount Ararat is between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. Mount Ararat is on what was the former border of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union on one side and Turkey on the other. A no man's land, very inhospitable place anyhow. So there's our northernmost place of the Bible lands for our consideration in these classes. And in at Mount Ararat, of course, something very significant occurred. What occurred there at Mount Ararat? Who remembers what happened at Mount Ararat? Okay, the Ark landed there. And that's where the you know, the flood was receding, and the universal flood, and the Ark landed there. So there's a very significant point, not only historically, but now we know a little bit about where it was. Then the southernmost part of the Bible lands would be Mount Sinai. So we have a mountain on the top and a mountain on the bottom. Mount Ararat, where Noah's Ark came to rest, on the north. And on the south, we have Mount Sinai. We had our maps up last week. We had one map where we had the Red Sea, and the Red Sea was blue and had two ears, a big ear and a little ear. And as the children were able to demonstrate for us, the big ear is what we call the Gulf of Suez now, and the little ear is the Gulf of Aqaba. But the rabbit had an injury. He had a bump on his head right between the two ears at the base is Mount Sinai. What happened at Mount Sinai? Okay, Moses received from God the Ten Commandments or the law right there at that location. So that's a very significant event and place as well. And then on the eastern side of the Bible lands, we have the Persian Gulf. On my maps, I call it the blue pig. You know, we're looking down on it, we saw its back, two hind legs, and a tail. There's our blue pig, the Persian Gulf. And so there's the eastern, furthest eastern part of the Bible lands. Then on the western side, we have the city of Rome, and that, of course, would be in Italy. We have some references in the Bible that go beyond Rome, but for the most part, we're dealing with Rome to the Persian Gulf, and we're dealing with Mount Ararat down to Mount Sinai. Pardon? Okay. And so we're talking about 2,200 miles east to west. 2,200 miles. And north to south are talking about 900 miles. Now, when talking to children, they don't have any idea about that sort of thing. Maybe we have difficulty also grasping that. What is the width of this country, the USA? What's the average width from Canada to the Gulf? Pardon? No, that would be closer to going the other way from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It's 1,500. Approximately between Canada, I don't know if it's whether to the Gulf or to Miami, but the general width of the USA, continental US, is 1,500 miles. And so think about, now, if I were to go from Memphis, Tennessee, to the western edge of Pennsylvania, or going to Ohio, I'd be traveling to the center of Ohio about 900 miles. And I don't know what it is from here. I haven't got all those things figured out just yet, but give you an idea of how what distance we're talking about. And then from the west coast to the east coast or vice versa, approximately 3,000 miles. So if our continental U.S. is approximately 1,500 miles north and south by 3,000 miles east and west, and the Bible lands are 2,200 miles wide and 900 miles from top to bottom, what's the relationship in size between continental U.S. and the Bible lands? So the continental U.S. is bigger. And what comprises most of the Bible lands, as you may recall? Water, the Mediterranean Sea, and other bodies of water. And so we're already beginning to see that, comparatively speaking, the Bible lands is a relatively small land mass compared to something with which we're more familiar, the continental U.S. And so as we begin to see that the Bible lands are generally speaking smaller than those things with which we're familiar, we'll begin to see that anything happening in the Bible lands affected everybody. If your neighbor's house burns down, it's going to affect your house, isn't it? You might get some heat damage. You might get some, you'll have a lot of traffic on your street as people come in to put it out and to investigate and whatever. And so whatever happens in the Bible lands anywhere, for the most part, would affect other people in the Bible lands, particularly those who were closer. It becomes even more acute when we talk about the land of Palestine, which we will, as far as something happening in an area affecting everybody. When we were looking at the maps last Wednesday, we made mention that something called the Fertile Crescent. I referred to it as a rainbow-shaped piece of land. If you can vision the map and some of the names that I used to describe it, we go from the Pig's Tail, the Persian Gulf, we go in a northwestwardly direction in an arc fashion up to the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea, under the elephant's nose, I said. It looks like an elephant's head with a trunk in that particular part of the map, or the world, or my maps in particular. You may recall that underneath the elephant's nose were two cities, Antioch of Syria and Seleucia. And then the Fertile Crescent continues down in a southwesterly direction all the way to Egypt and the Nile River. And so it's a fertile crescent. Fertile means things grow there. And a crescent means it's a half moon shaped, or it's a rainbow shaped. And so we have the Fertile Crescent being where in antiquity we have the most population centers initially. We have the earliest things man left over from his antiquity in the Fertile Crescent. Mankind expanded to the rest of the planet from the vicinity of the Fertile Crescent, from the Persian Gulf up to the northeastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea down to Egypt. And so we have primary rivers that are watering the Fertile Crescent as far as the eastern half of that crescent is concerned. We have the Nile River that is watering Egypt and that part of the Fertile Crescent. And so the Tigris and Euphrates rivers are the primary rivers that watered the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent. Now, north of this Fertile Crescent, we have what I refer to as a rock garden, with the prettiest rock in it being Mount Ararat. So we have mountains above the Fertile Crescent, and among those mountains we have Ararat, where Noah's Ark came to rest. And below the Fertile Crescent we have inhospitable desert. And as far as that goes, if the Nile River weren't there, there wouldn't be people living of any great number in Egypt, because the only way they could have cities, they could have farming, the only place they could have sufficient water for a population is because of the existence of the Nile River. So we have the Fertile Crescent, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers being the eastern, watering the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent, and then the Nile River watering the part of the Fertile Crescent where it concludes in Egypt. And we have rivers also that we'll notice in Palestine and also in Syria. Now, there are large bodies of water that are involved in this Bible lands that we just mentioned. And, of course, the largest of which would be what? What's the largest body of water in the Bible lands? We've already mentioned it. Pardon? Yes. A couple years ago, my daughter Rebecca and I walked into a Sam's Club, and they were giving free hearing tests. And my daughter said to me, "Don't you think you ought to go get a hearing test, Dad?" And I said, "What?" And we walked on. So if I don't hear you, you might have to tell me again. So Mediterranean Sea is the largest body of water in the Bible lands. It's 2,300 miles long, 680 miles wide, and about 14,000 feet deep. That's a pretty big bowl of water. 2,300 miles long, 680 miles wide, 14,000 feet deep. Now, in this country, we have the Great Lakes. And I used to live in the northern peninsula of Michigan when I was in the Air Force. And I got to visit three Great Lakes as they converge right there at the straits, well, above the northern peninsula, and then two of them converge at the southern part there at the Straits of Mackinac. So I got to visit those Great Lakes. Those lakes are so big that they have their own weather patterns. Those lakes are so big, those five Great Lakes are so big, that there are whole fleets of ships that sank in the same storms and lie in the bottoms of those lakes. And so the Mediterranean Sea, likewise, is so big It has terrible weather certain portions of the year, so that in antiquity there was not much shipping done between November and February. They've got these little wooden boats, ships, and so they're going to be ferrying grain, or they're going to be ferrying other things, might use ships for warfare or troop movement or whatever. And they couldn't do it very effectively at certain times of the year because the sea was too rough and they would be in danger of sinking. We have one occasion in the book of Acts where that, in fact, was the case. Is that right? Who was it that got to be shipwrecked? Paul. And then he also said in another place that he was shipwrecked more than once, didn't he? And so this has to do with this big sea. You're not running these ships on the Sea of Galilee. You're running boats on the Sea of Galilee, not running ships. You can't sail on the Jordan River because it's not navigable. And so Lake Huron was only about 11 feet deep. You couldn't do that. Couldn't have a big ship over there. And so the Mediterranean Sea was very dangerous, bad weather, rough seas from November through February. And usually in ancient times, wooden ships would sail in sight of land. I didn't know for sure until I learned this a couple years ago that supposedly, as far as we can see, the number of nautical miles maximum that we can see, the number of miles maximum we can see over a body of water is 10 miles. If the atmosphere is clear, we can see up to 10 miles because of the curvature of the earth. You know, people would be in port someplace, and first thing they'd see about a ship coming from a distance would be the crow's nest, or the top of the mast as it comes around the earth, as the earth is rounded. And so they wouldn't sail usually beyond sight of land. They wouldn't sail usually beyond 10 miles away from what they could see as far as the Mediterranean Sea was concerned. And so it was a very, very, very adventurous endeavor for people like Columbus and Magellan and others to just go on out there and sail in those wooden ships where they can't see land anymore and wouldn't see land for a long, long time. And so anciently, Bible times usually sailed within sight of land. Now, Palestine didn't make very much use of the Mediterranean Sea because there are very few good harbors along Palestine, so they didn't use it. So the Mediterranean Sea is the largest body of water in the Bible lands. We also have the Persian Gulf that we mentioned. It's 520 miles long, 200 feet deep. And then we have two rivers, two primary rivers that flow into it. And again, those being the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, as we'll notice a little bit later, that they come together and converge about 100 miles before they get to the Persian Gulf. They flow as one from that point, and that's referred to as the Shatt al-Arab from that point. Then we have the Caspian Sea on our map site. It's blue, of course. It's water. I refer to it as Casper the Friendly Ghost, as far as a funny name is concerned, Caspian Sea. It has some interesting characteristics. It's the largest body of water surrounded by land in the world. It's the largest salt lake in the world. It's 700 miles from top to bottom and 130 to 170 miles wide and 3,200 feet deep. And the Caspian Sea, along with the Black Sea that's not far away from it, again, Mount Ararat is between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. The Black Sea is on the west and the Caspian Sea is on the east of Mount Ararat. The Caspian and Black Seas form a natural boundary between Europe and Asia. Then there's the Red Sea we made mention a little while ago. It's about 1,500 miles long, 1,500 miles long. It ranges in width from about 180 miles to 250 miles, and it's about 1,500 feet deep. And its average temperature is 80 degrees. Now, 80 degrees sounds pretty good, but our body temperatures are 98.6, except if you're a little bit different than everybody else, and that happens. 98.6. So anything that is very much less than 98.6 seems cold. And 98.6, 99 seems to be about lukewarm to us. and then something more than that is hot, we think. So it's about 80 degrees, usually. The 2 years, as we mentioned, the Gulf of Suez on the western side of the bump on the Rabbit's Head, or Mount Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula. On the right side, Gulf of Aqaba. And Aqaba is one of the few words in the English language that does not have a U following the Q. But you can't use proper names in Scrabble anyhow, so that probably won't do you any good in that regard. Gulf of Aqaba. And so between the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba, we have the Israelites wandering for 40 years in that Sinai Peninsula, very inhospitable area, very desert-like area. And so that's between those two rabbit ears that we mentioned. Black Sea, it is not mentioned in the Bible. It is 750 miles by 400 miles. It's 7,300 feet deep. At one time, it was the largest freshwater lake in the world. How in the world can that be? How could it be at one time, but not now? How could it be that at one time it was the largest freshwater lake in the world? How do you explain that? Anybody care to venture an answer? How could it have been the largest freshwater lake in the world, but now it's salt water? How could it have changed? Anybody know? Must be climate change. No. Well, no, not a canal. It must be climate change. Climate change is not new. The water levels have raised about 500 feet from previous times in the Black Sea. And so now the Black Sea and the Mediterranean Sea touch each other through a natural waterway, a natural canal. As a matter of fact, on the bottom of the Black Sea are whole towns or cities. The houses are still down there. The wagons are down there. The tools are down there. Things are like they just walked away one day and left it all there. It's still down there. But the Black Sea had a rise in water. Don't know how long it took to do that. 500 feet that eventually connected it with the Mediterranean Sea, or connected the Mediterranean Sea with it. And since Mediterranean Sea is salt water, as it's connected to the oceans that are salt water, and the Mediterranean Sea may or may not have its own salt water source, salt water flows into the Black Sea. It's no longer the largest freshwater lake in the world. But it's not specifically mentioned in Scripture. And then for the few moments we have left before we conclude tonight, some major rivers, the Tigris River. Again, I refer to these as the grasshopper antenna. They're running through the eastern part of this fertile crescent. They come together and form the Shatt al-Arab, and it touches the Pig's Tail, the Persian Gulf. And so I refer to them as the grasshopper antenna because they're kind of squiggly, and they go back, they go up together for a while, then they go like this. And so the land between the rivers, referred to as Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers is the cradle of human civilization as far as archaeology has been able to determine. The Tigris River is about 1,150 miles long. And one of the most important cities on its bank was what? Anybody happen to remember or know? What was one of the most important or one of the most significant Bible cities, Bible land cities on the banks of the Tigris River? Not that one. That comes up with our next river. Yes, Nineveh. I think I heard that. Nineveh. And of course, that was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And then we'll get down to, in a moment, to the Euphrates River, and Babylon was the chief city on the banks of the Euphrates River. Now, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 14, the Tigris River goes by a different name. If you recall, or were a speedy looker-upper of Bible text, well, you'd find that the answer there is, it's referred to as the Hiddekel. The Hiddekel and the Tigris are the same thing. So we're going to find out in very short order that two of the rivers in Genesis that we're told flowed through the Garden of Eden, we know where they are. And one of which is the Tigris River or the Hiddekel, and the other of which is the Euphrates River. So we don't know exactly where Eden was, but we have a general idea as to where Eden was, because there were four rivers running through Eden, and two of them still exist to the present. Another dry riverbed from another of them has been discovered, but we have a general idea. And so when you put these pieces together, just incidentally, the Garden of Eden was in Iraq. We've been bombing Iraq years ago in various wars, and the Babylonian city, Babylon on the Euphrates River, was in Iraq. Nineveh was in Iraq. Don't know where exactly the Garden of Eden was or what its size was, but it would have been in that part of the world that is generally referred to as Iraq today. The Euphrates River is referred to by many as the most important river in the Bible. It is a point of reference for so many different biblical texts. We find it in Genesis 2:14 regarding one of the rivers in the Garden of Eden. It's sometimes referred to as the river, sometimes referred to as the great river. It was a northern boundary between the Israelite kingdom and the rest of the world in that direction during the time of King Solomon. And so King Solomon's kingdom extended in that direction up to the Euphrates River. It was a northern boundary. And so this river is 1,675 miles long. And then there's the Orontes River. The Orontes River is in Palestine. Well, it's in Syria, actually. It's in Syria, north of Palestine. And it's under the elephant's nose. It flows about 250 miles and empties into the Mediterranean Sea. It's one of the few rivers in the world that flows north. And so Antioch of Syria is on the Orontes River. And Seleucia was the seaport city for Antioch of Syria. So Paul began and ended his missionary journeys at Antioch of Syria. But the port city from which he would have begun and ended those journeys would be the port city of Seleucia. It was the port part of that area. And Antioch was the city. It was a notable population center there. And so that river be aware of it only. We'll close out in the last 2 minutes that we have regarding rivers and talking about the Nile River. Later we'll get into the rivers in particular regarding Palestine. But here, the Nile River, it's the longest river system in the world. If I were to ask people in Mississippi what's the longest river in the world, it would certainly be the Mississippi River. It's almost as long as the Nile River. It's about 3,900 miles long. If you lived in South America and I asked you the longest river in the world, it'd be the Amazon. It's almost as long as the Nile River. But the longest river system in the world is the Nile River, which is over 4,000 miles long. And again, another river that flows north. The Nile River begins as two rivers that merge. Begins as the Blue Nile and the White Nile, and they come together and form the Nile River. They flow north. They flow from highlands toward a coast, the Mediterranean coast, on the northeastern side or shoulder of the African continent. And so again, without the Nile River, there wouldn't be any Egypt. Egypt is referred to as the gift of the Nile by reason of that. One of the important things regarding the Nile River, the last thing about which we'll have time to say anything tonight, is every year the Nile River floods. That's not unusual. Not having dam systems and so forth along the Mississippi River, maybe other rivers in this country, we'd have a lot more flooding than we do. But the Nile River would flood, and as it would flood, and as it's bringing down all this soil from further up upland, as it floods, it would deposit this soil in the fields. And so you sow your seed upon the water, and it has all this rich soil in it, and the water recedes, leaves the soil, and you've got your seed and your new earth, your fertilized ground, as it were, mixed together, and you have a crop. So we have some more backgrounds in particular with regard to that part of the world and the Nile River and flooding and planting and growing. Anybody, any concluding comments, questions, or criticisms before we ready ourselves for our devotional tonight? Anybody, anything at all? If you think of something later, bring it up next time we're together, or talk to us after services, or whatever we can do to be of assistance to you. Hope that it's been interesting to you. It's something over which I never tire. Thank you very much.